Body, Mind, Spirit Radio, your life connection to the information for a healthy body, an enlightened mind, and a renewed spirit.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Integrity in Action, live on Body, Mind, Spirit Radio, monthly on the third Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. This is your opportunity to listen live with host Lois Shulman, empowerment coach, facilitator, and public speaker of Integrity Action, LLC. She will interview with sensitivity, unconditional love, and without judgment, individuals who have chosen to exemplify the highest levels of ethical principles, sound moral character, and honesty. Each month, the featured guests will share their story. These interviews will give listeners an opportunity to feel the passion and emotion of the person being interviewed, as well as inspire listeners to entertain a new perspective from which to expand their own understanding. When this occurs, we move beyond the limitations of our current thinking to heal and become more aware, awake, and expansive. And now I give you your host, Lois Shulman.
I'm here today with my dear friend, and I met in the early 1980s while attending a political event. My husband at the time was a candidate. John had opposing views to my husband. I was uncomfortable around John and intimidated by his knowledge and the articulate way he discussed the issues. Now, bring many years later, John heard I was interested in serving on a board that he serves on, and he encouraged me to submit my name for a position on the board. The board serves those in the community by way of providing a safety net for those in need. I was honored and amazed that John would choose to encourage me to serve. I always felt in such awe of his ability to serve our community in many capacities. Today, I've come to know this man as a gentleman and a scholar. I have come to respect and seek mentoring guidance from John. He shares his experiences and wisdom with others, such as myself, to encourage and offer hope for our dreams. He continues each day to shine a light for me. His gift to me is himself. John, I want to ask you, what motivated you to travel the road you have chosen?
Well, first of all, thank you for allowing me this opportunity. In my 80th year, it's questionable how much value I still have to the world at large and to individual segments of that world. And it's nice to have somebody come and validate the fact that I still have something to offer. And that is it's a very heartfelt feeling that I have, being affirmed that I still have some use. My road started out kind of interestingly. My mom was a single female head of household in 1941, before that phrase was even commonly in the vocabulary. My dad left when I was four. My grandmother came in, and God bless her, after her husband passed away, came in and helped to raise me. My mother went to work, and I am grateful that her parents saw fit to educate their daughter, and she had a degree in economics, not home economics, but economics, with a minor in accounting from Mary Grove College in Detroit. So she was able to find employment with the military during the Second World War and traveled the country as an auditor of the various military installations, which I thought at that time, I didn't know why she wasn't home, but in retrospect, for a woman at that point in time, that was pretty awesome. In retrospect, I say, wow, you go, girl. My mom was awesome, and I just really didn't appreciate how awesome she was. But I also give credit to her parents for educating their daughter in something other than what at that time would have been home economics. The next step, if you will, I was blessed, if you will, to have the opportunity of having a private education in a Jesuit high school, University of Detroit High School, Jesuit High, and it was kind of interesting because those were very formative years for me because I was absent a father, no older brothers, my mom didn't have any brothers, and so I was kind of adrift in terms of who I was. Going to an all-boys high school kind of began to help me stabilize a little bit into who I was. And I did have an opportunity to have some leadership opportunities there. But the interesting thing, and one that serves me to this day, The motto of the U of D Jesuit High School is Men for Others. That was a visionary statement far, far ahead of its time, and one which imprinted on my heart and my mind, and to which I carry to this day, being a man for others, not to serve myself, but to serve others who are in need of whatever help I might be able to afford to them. And then I went to the University of Detroit Mercy, graduated with a degree in economics and business administration, and was blessed, again, I say that word advisedly, blessed to be inducted into a fraternity, Phi Sigma Kappa fraternity at the University of Detroit at that time, a fantastic group of young men who weren't afraid to step up and do the right thing for the right reason. I ended up being president of the chapter before I graduated in 1959 and was a non-drinking fraternity president, if you can believe that. And our chapter did so well that the national office asked me if I would please consider going to work for them and travel the country as a troubleshooter and somebody who could help struggling chapters. And so for the next 2.5 years, I said to my media boss, Herbert Brown, I said, "Boss, give me the chapters that you don't think are going to make it through the school year." And he would look at me over his spectacles and say, "Are you kidding?" And I said, "No, sir. Give me the ones you don't think are going to make it." He said, "Okay, but don't come back on me about this." I said, "No, sir, I won't." Well, at the end of 2.5 years, I can honestly say, very truthfully, not one chapter that I was assigned to had ceased to exist. They were all still fully functional. And I'm not saying that in a boastful manner. I'm just saying that whatever gifts the good Lord has given me to help ameliorate situations, motivate individuals, be empathetic, whatever gifts I had, I was able to use.
And at a very young age, too.
And it paid off. Yeah, I sometimes surprised myself that things went so well that I didn't get taken out in the backyard, beat to a pulp because of, shall we say, kicking behinds and taking names. But tough love paid off. And these kids understood that I was an individual who respected them as individuals, but also set expectations and to try to give them a reputation to live up to instead of one to live down. And in all honesty, if you follow that philosophy, you will be absolutely amazed that people will step up and actually live up to that reputation you are giving them, in spite of whatever history they might have. So then, moving along, I was told that I had a certain skill set that I should work with young people, work with students. So I applied to a master's degree program in guidance and counseling at Michigan State University and transferred up there and completed the master's degree and then was told that I should continue, which I did, and entered into a doctoral program in higher educational administration with a focus on community colleges. And again, being in the right place at the right time, as I was finishing the doctorate, my boss, who was John Porter at that time, minority superintendent of public instruction in Michigan, asked me to come in his office and said, "You know, John, there's an opportunity I think you should look at. I have gentlemen in my office who are going to be the leadership of the last chartered community college in Michigan." And I said, "Oh, wow." I said, "Where's that?" And he said, "In your backyard, right in Detroit." Keeping in mind, this was 2 years after the riots of Detroit in 1967. And I looked at him and I said, "Do you really think I should?" He said, "You're perfect for it. Go in, sit down, talk to him." So I did. And a 15-minute job interview turned out to be a 30-year career. Talk about right place, right time, right reason. And that was my professional blessing at that time, because I was able to be and administrator, first full-time administrator at an urban community college, predominantly African-American enrollment. We opened our doors in the fall of 1969, expecting 2,000 students to come in. We got 8,000 students.
Oh, my gosh.
And everybody went, oh, my God, what are we going to do? Well, guess what? We went around. We moved into church basements. We moved into storefronts. We moved into community rooms in the shopping malls. We were everywhere you could think of where we could bring a professor in to teach a class. And I was their first director of Student Financial Aid Placement and Veteran Services. And for 10 years, administered the state and federal financial aid program to over, well, I think at last count, well, cumulative count, it was in the tens of thousands. But initially, at least 80% of our student enrollment was on some form of financial aid and came through my office. And my five staff members, that's all, plus our work-study students, God bless them, with no electronic support, provided the necessary paperwork and processing and issuing of checks to help our students for the first time in their life have an opportunity to climb the ladder to some success in their life through the educational opportunity that they were desperately waiting for. So again, right time, right place, and truly blessed. After 10 years of financial aid administration, I moved into, at the president's request, being the college ombudsperson. Now, if you can kind of step back and think about that, this tired old white man, well, I wasn't so tired at that time, I still had the juice, but this white guy as the problem solver in a predominantly African-American institution. So either the president really hated me and wanted me to die a painful death, or for whatever reason thought that my skill sets and my history of running a financial aid office for 10 years gave me the necessary tools to ameliorate the problems within the college. And trust me, there were many, 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 many problems. But I always advocated for my students, and I basically trusted them, and I told them, I said, I have only one condition to move you forward with your complaint or your issue, and that is never lie to me. If you tell me the truth, I will go through a brick wall for you to solve your problem. If you lie to me, I don't ever want to see you in my office again. And that sounds a little harsh. Once the word got out, you'd be surprised how much honesty started to take its place, as it should be. And after 30 years, never missing a graduation, always being there for my students, giving them a congratulatory hug. My reputation is the Papa Bear, giving out awesome bear hugs. And I always had to remind people, just to be somewhat politically correct, a hug is a non-sexual physical validation of human worth. And many of our students had never been hugged in their entire life. And I don't mean any kind of other kind of touching, but a validation. And a hug is, like I said, a non-sexual physical validation of human worth. That became my mantra. I had a big sign in my office over my desk that said, hugs, not drugs. And I was truly blessed. I look back at this and I get a little emotional because I really invested huge amounts of my heart into my students, because as far as I was concerned, they were my legacy. If I could give them a reason to have a quality of life better than what they had coming into my office, then I consider that to be a blessing for me and a blessing for them. And it may sound a little bit esoteric, but it was factual. And it proved itself, because people would come back. When you're there for 30 years, it's like the teacher that taught your grandpa in class. After 30 years, I'd have my students, some of them would be coming back. And I don't mean just a handful. I mean lots of them would come back, showing me their bachelor's degrees, their master's degrees, their doctoral degrees, their job promotions, their pictures of their wedding and their kids and their grandkids. And I said to myself, you know, John, you can change the world one person at a time if you're willing to make the effort. And I know that sounds kind of a little, you know, rose-colored glasses, but it's absolutely true. Because I said to my students, if you can find a job that you love so much, you would do it for free, no pay. If you had money in the bank and your bills are paid, if you can find a job that you would do that for free, you will be happy. And if you're happy, you'll be healthy, and you will live a life that you and your family and your kids and your grandkids can look back with pride and say, look at what my grandma did, or look what my dad did. And they will follow in your footsteps. We can break the chains of poverty. We can break the chains of ignorance, but we have to exert the effort to make that happen. So I'm kind of running out of steam for a little bit, Lois, so I'll pass the ball over to you.
So I was curious where, I didn't know about this, all this background, but where was your political career? Because that's when you and I met with the politics.
My political career. Now, at the risk of people turning off their stations or disconnecting their phones or whatever we're doing on this podcast, and I have no idea. I'm sitting here totally ignorant. I'm an electronically challenged senior citizen, so I have no idea which cloud this is going out on or what planet we may be visiting. I basically said, I want to affiliate with an organization that is attempting, maybe not always succeeding, but attempting to improve the quality of life for all the citizens of this country and doing it without shaming and blaming. And at the moment, my first vote had to be for somebody who I thought was wishfully my grandfather, was Dwight Eisenhower. Yes, I'm that old. I voted for Dwight Eisenhower, my first presidential vote. I also voted for George Romney, who I thought reminded me of a biblical prophet with his shock of white hair and his stature and his demeanor. So those are my two votes, one for governor of Michigan and one for president of the United States. And I have been relatively comfortable in the Republican Party, and I know I'm about to step on a landmine here, but as a parent of a foster child, a biological child, an adopted child, Republican Party support for pro-life was very, very meaningful to me because the Holocaust of 61 million dead children was something that absolutely horrified me to the core of my soul. And regardless of the issue of women's choice, and I do not want to be seen as somebody denying a woman her choice, but I also say, what about the baby's choice? And should not that receive equal time? So politically, yes, I'm on the Republican side, and I don't apologize to anybody for that. And I will stand up and take issue for things that I don't feel are appropriate, stands that various candidates have taken that I don't agree with. I don't just go along to get along. I will stand up and I will challenge. And 8 years of Jesuit training definitely gives me a pretty good skill set to go toe-to-toe and nose-to-nose with people debating political positions and rationale.
So then how did you get to be on the Oakland County Community Mental Health Board?
Well, it was sort of a default appointment. Not too many people know the history, so I guess at this point in life, what the heck. I had been lined up for an appointment to be Oakland County Board of Commissioners, and I had solicited what I thought was sufficient number of votes for that appointment, and then at the last minute, the member of that board, who's not currently on anymore, yes, the wheels of justice turn slowly, but she's no longer on the board, and managed to sabotage my campaign, and the members of the board who were supporting me felt so badly about how I'd been treated. They offered me an appointment to the Community Mental Health Board. Well, with my back history as a counselor at the college and my training is my master's degree in guidance and counseling, it was a very good fit. Again, here we go, being in the right place at the right time for the right reason. Now, it may not have been what I went in there as a first choice, but I did not leave there disappointed that somehow I had lost. Let us say, higher power sometimes has different plans for you, and you don't always end up where you think you should be, but you end up where you don't end up where you think you could be, but you end up where you should be. And community mental health was a perfect fit for me, both at the local level, at the state level. I also ended up being at the statewide board for children's services, the statewide board for suicide prevention, and on and on and on and on, and a very vocal advocate for those in our community who are most vulnerable and who desperately need the love, the support, and the understanding of the members of our community. And sometimes they don't necessarily receive that, not in the way that they should.
So how do you, I know when you left the board, you asked me to step into your shoes and to help to keep the things going, the issues that you felt were important. And that's where I look to you as a mentor, because when you asked me to do that, it encouraged me, and I was so honored that you even asked me to do that. So,
well, Lois, without sounding like a mutual admiration society meeting here, finding an individual that has the kind of good heart that you have, the professional tools that you have and skill sets that you have, the compassion, the sensitivity, and more importantly, the determination to not throw up your hands the minute you run into a wall, but you kind of figure out a way to go around it, under it, through it, somehow or other, you are not going to be prevented from accomplishing what you feel is a righteous cause just because the road gets a little bumpy. And when I saw that tenacity, and you do not come across as, you know, the tiger mom, you know, kind of person, you know, but you do have a focused intensity for righteous causes, and you put your whole self into it, that to me rang all the bells that needed to be rung for me to throw whatever support I provided to get you appointed to the board politically. A few blue chips, you know, tossed into the pot. But once you were on that board, I think everybody realized what a treasure you were, and the commissioners have seen fit to reappoint you numerous times now. So that just validates my original observation and decision to support you.
But the interesting thing is that it was your encouragement that helped me to become that person, because you saw in me something that at the time I didn't even see myself. But I was so honored that you asked me that I would never want to let you down. Yeah. So I guess that's why I wanted to interview you, because you have this beautiful ability to see strengths in others. And from your training, you just shared that this was instilled in you in your Jesuit training, and also in the fraternity that you joined, which I knew nothing about.
Absolutely.
But that's the gift.
Well, Lois, like I said, you know, the Lord has a plan, and sometimes our ego gets in the way and our vanity gets in the way of that plan because we think we know better. But sometimes you need to let go and let God, and it's amazing how that actually turns out. You end up being in the right place at the right time for the right reason, and you do the right thing. And if more people could do that, this world would just be so much better. And I've got a little tiny little quote here that I want to share. And this is from a dear, dear friend of mine, the Baroness Caroline Cox of Queensbury, very proper English lady, also a member of the House of Lords. And I was privileged to make her acquaintance many, many years ago. And this lady, in my opinion, is the Mother Teresa / Florence Nightingale of this world right now. This lady literally flies into countries where they shoot at her plane. They do everything possible to prevent her from. She is a registered nurse, and she brings medical supplies, and she does food, and she does water purification. She does things for corners of the world that everyone has forgotten about, where people are being treated so inhumanely marginally genocide. And this lady has the courage and the authority has protected her. She showed me pictures of her plane, one of her planes that she was in, and she showed me the plane with the bullet holes in the fuselage. And she said, John, she said, I didn't put these here, but I was in a seat close by where one of them passed through the plate. And I said, Baroness, I don't know. She said, the only reason I can do this is there's a higher power protecting me to do my job. So this was her little saying she shared with me. She said, I am only one, but I am one. I cannot do everything, but I can do something. And I will not let what I cannot do interfere with what I can do. That is such a simple saying. And yet it is so powerful, because a lot of us use the excuse, well, I'm only one person. Well, she's saying, okay, you're one person. So what are you going to do? And I think that challenge ought to be given to all of our young people who sit back and complain about everything but fail to step up and shoulder some responsibility for making things better. And I wish and pray that my grandchildren, my 8 grandchildren, will grow up into a world less toxic, less confrontational, and more peaceful than what I've experienced in my 80 years.
So when you were a counselor at the college, you said it was in the time of the race riots?
Shortly after that, it was 1969 when we opened our doors. The riots took place in 1967. And I was at a bachelor party in downtown Detroit that evening, and with 16 other friends of mine, and we were in an apartment complex that literally overlooked the city. Lafayette Towers, I think, Lafayette Place, and we literally joined hands, and most of us were in tears, watching what we saw, tanks, military, people in the streets shooting looters, and we took a vow at that time, all 16 of us, that we would stay in our city and personally and professionally do everything possible to prevent what we were seeing from ever occurring again. I'm very proud and pleased to say every single one of those gentlemen followed through with their vow and their commitment. Some went into the judiciary, to law. Some went into medicine. Some went into education. Like I ended up in the education niche, if you will. Others went into other professions. But every one of them stayed in the city. Several have passed away. Maybe it's because I don't drink or smoke that I'm still hanging around, but I don't want to point that finger at anybody. But everyone stayed and honored their vow. And I think that's one of the reasons, even though the city of Detroit still is not a place that I would like to brag about, but it is on its way back. I think it may achieve its greatness again, maybe not in my lifetime, but in the lifetime of my grandchildren. It just was a motivating moment, and one which I have emblazoned in my brain like as if it was yesterday.
I have a question, because in my introduction of you, I mentioned that I was intimidated by you. You had different thoughts than me. I just felt that you were judging me when I first met you. And how did you move past that, being with people that were entirely different than you, different in color skin, but also different in the way they looked at the world? So how do you develop a trust when you're working with young people who look at you as maybe the enemy and somebody that frightens them, they don't want to be?
Well, I will be very honest with you, Lois. When I first started working at the college, a lot of my friends from the burbs, we were living in Royal Oak, or I'm sorry, when I first started, we were living in Farmington. We were living in Farmington in our first apartment, and my wife and I. And my wife is a junior high English teacher. She actually quit her job after 3 or 4 years because we were attempting to conceive a child, and the stress of my job and her job best environment for conception to take place. So it's hard to actually pinpoint that point in my life where I think the event where I saw the city in flames, I think the traveling with my fraternity where conflict resolution became a skill set that was absolutely mandatory for me to have to use, seeing situations citywide, statewide, and nationwide that needed to be addressed, that needed remediation. I think it was a whole combination of events, people, places, times coming together, which said to me, you can either be part of the problem or you can be part of the solution. If you're going to be part of the solution, you better have a pretty stiff spine, you better have a pretty thick skin, and you better have a pretty sharp mind. But most importantly, you better have a caring heart. And I think at that particular juncture, all the pieces sort of came into place. And I said to myself, okay, I'm only one, but I am one. And I can do something. And that something is to share whatever the good Lord has given me in terms of a skill set to help individual people. And I firmly believe, and I've said this a zillion times during my career, you can change the world one person at a time if you're willing to invest the effort and the time. If you can do that and you can change that person's life, change their direction, motivate them, sow seeds of hope in the hearts of desperate folk, the harvest that you will reap as a member of the community is inestimable. You cannot even understand how great the dividends of the harvest, the results of your efforts will be. But most people are too lazy, they're too self-centered, too selfish, too busy with things in their life to be able to look outside themselves and be a person for others, not just a person for themselves, but a person for others. And they just cannot seem to jump that hurdle to the other side of the fence where the me becomes a we. And when that happens, the we suddenly has empowerment to change the world.
Have you met people that you have a difficult time communicating with, and how do you handle that?
Well, one incident comes to mind, and this is initially a little bit traumatic, but there's a big humorous side to it. There is a lady, and I will not use her last name, but a minority lady by the first name of Elsie, who stormed into my office at the college. I was a financial aid director, stormed into my office, waving a gun and screaming at the top of her lungs, where is her blank work-study check? And my staff, the ones that weren't hiding under their desks, one of them grabbed the phone and called my extension and said, Mr. B, we got a problem here. And I said, what? Lady with a gun. I said, send her in my office.
Yeah.
And they said, are you sure? I said, send her into my office. So Elsie comes to the door. She's got her waving her gun in her hand, screaming at the top of her lungs. I sat in my chair and very quietly said, Ms. I can't use her name, I'll just say, Elsie, what can I do to help you? I want my blanky blank 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 check. I said, well, I think you should get that check. You deserve that check, right? Yes. Would you like me to help make that happen? Can you do that? And I said, well, I think I can, but I think I could operate a lot better if I don't feel like you're going to shoot me before I can help you. And she said, oh, I'm so sorry. And she put the gun in her purse. And she started reducing the vocal level. And pretty soon I said, could you come and sit down next to my desk and give me a little bit more information so I can make this happen so that you'll actually have a check before you leave the building? Oh, yeah, of course. So she sits down, and we started a conversation, and I said, did you turn in your timesheet? Yeah. And blah, 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 some more stuff. I said, I'm going to make a phone call. Now, just rest assured, I'm not calling the police. I'm making a phone call to our accounting office upstairs. I picked up the phone and got the accounting supervisor on the line. I said, this is John Brokers. I know your voice, Mr. Brokers. What can I do for you? I said, well, I have a young lady down here. She wasn't really a young lady, but I wanted to give her a little compliment. She said, I've got a young lady down here who's a little bit upset that her work study check wasn't there when she went to the cashier's window. I said, could you please check and see where the paperwork might be on this? They said, can you give me a minute? I said, yes. So I said to Elsie, my mouth was, they're working on it. She said, oh, that's good. And I said, okay. And so in a few minutes, they came back and they said, well, we think we found the problem. I said, well, I'm looking at the problem right now next to my desk. I said, I'm looking at the problem, or I'm looking at the result of the problem. And they said, well, what do you want us to do? And I said, is there any doubt in your mind? I want you to cut a check for this lady, and I want you to do it the next 30 minutes, because I'm going to send her and her gun upstairs.
You did say gun?
And they said, what? The voice, their voice raised way up. I said, well, no, she's not going to have her gun when she comes up to see you. She had her gun when she came to see me, but she doesn't have the gun anymore. And
knowing you, I know you said that.
Of course I did. And Elsie is sitting next to me. Well, now she's laughing. She's tears running down her face. She's saying, I don't believe what you're saying. I said, I don't believe what I'm saying either, Elsie, but we're going to get this solved. So I said, can I send her up in 30 minutes? I will walk up with her, and I do expect that there will be a check ready for her. They said, okay. I said, 30 minutes. I'm going to be up there. So for the next 30 minutes, Elsie and I sat and had a lovely conversation. She told me about her family. She told me about her, why she chose the career. And I apologize, I can't think of what career she was in. But here was a lady who was in her probably late 40s, early 50s, who had had a very, very difficult life. And this college opportunity was her way out, her ladder up out to a better life. And she had carried over into her behaviors a lot of her personal history. And there was a lot of violence in her personal history, not violence that she caused, but violence that was, you know, put upon her. So she was very defensive, and that was one of the reasons she was carrying a weapon. Whether or not it was registered or not, I didn't want to get into that. But anyhow, so we just had a lovely conversation. We ended up hugging. We ended up walking out. I had my arm around her. She had her arm around me. My staff were going nuts. They looked at us and they went, what the heck did he do? You know? And I said, hang on. Elsie and I are going upstairs. We're going to take care of her problem. I'll be back. If anybody had an appointment to see me, just ask me patient and wait. I'll be back. And we got in the elevator, went from the second floor to the fifth floor. Walked over to the cashier's office, and the cashier's eyes were about this big. And I said, they said, we know why you're here, Mr. Booker. We know why you're here. I said, okay, this is Elsie, and you have her check. Is that correct? Yes, 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 we have her check. I said, okay, that's fine. Thank you for being so speedy and taking care of business. I appreciate that courtesy, and have a blessed day. And we turned around, went back to the elevator. On the way down, Elsie said, do you mind if I don't get off on your floor, John, or Mr. Booker? I said, no, Elsie, I don't mind if you don't get off on your floor. I said, are you double parked up there? She said, I don't remember where I parked. I was so upset and so angry, I may have parked in the middle of the street. I said, I hope not. And so she said, she hugged me again, and she said, thank you so much. I said, no, Elsie, thank you, because you had a righteous cause and a righteous reason. Your behaviors were a little bit over the top. But I understand, based on your background, why you did what you did. Just make me one promise. Leave that gun at home when you come to class. And she said, okay, I can do that. And that was the end of that story. And it was one of those wonderful, wonderful times where you do realize that you can change the world one person at a time. You just have to make the time and the effort and be open and be compassionate and be understanding. You don't have to perform miracles. All you have to do is be human and recognize that here's a human being who has an issue, that they're frustrated, that they don't see anybody will give them the time to solve their problem.
But what's so important and what I've learned from you is that even though you have your own moral views, your own religious views, that you're able to look at another human being and see that what they need in order to feel comfortable, and that's your priority, is to make somebody feel comfortable with you and have trust in you, because then you can change somebody.
Well, I hope that my ethics or standards or whatever they might be based on high school, based on college, based on graduate school, based on work experience, I'm hopeful that all of those actually facilitate and serve as a catalyst for me to be the person that I strive to be every day. And I try not to let any of those be a barrier or be a filter or be a preventative, be doing the right thing for the right reason at the right time. And I know this little cliche kind of stuff that I've been using in my conversation here, but these are the core of who I am. These are the things that I live by, and these are the things that allow me to sleep very well at night. All things considered, in spite of my arthritis and my spinal stenosis. Can we have another half hour here to discuss my medical issues?
No, I want to know more about just your heart, because in this world today, people are so don't have time to listen to each other. So we pass each other. We make an assumption based on how we're dressed, the color of our skin, and it ends there. Where with you, it didn't end there. It ended with trying to understand that person that was speaking to you, maybe in a way that you did not feel comfortable around, or had a color of skin that perhaps you were afraid of based on your experience, or dressed in a certain way.
Well, another phrase that is rather trite, but we all bleed red. One thing we have in common is we all bleed red. So when we're in pain and when we're hurting, there is no color except the red. And red should be a signal of need to help. It's like the Red Cross that the lifesavers wear on their lifeguards wear on their chests. You know, we need to see that red. We need to see the lifesaver cross on our chest, that we are there to respond to those calls of help, regardless of who is issuing that cry, regardless of the circumstances that they may have placed themselves in. That cry for help should resonate deep within us as another human being who needs us, and we don't hesitate not a second to say, let's see, go through the checklist, you know, what religion, what color, you know, what political party, what socioeconomic status, et cetera, et cetera. No, we don't do the checklist. We just say, this is one of God's children, you need help, and you jump in, and you do the best you can to save it. Now, sometimes lifeguards will tell you they have to knock out the person that they're trying to save, or that person will drown both of them. And I said, sometimes you have to do deliver a psychological knockout punch where I have to get the person literally to back down from where they have managed to climb up to scream their grievances or whatever issues that are motivating them to be upset. Sometimes I have to kind of give them a little bit of a knockout punch and bring it back down so that they can catch their breath, take a minute, know and understand that this is somebody who wants to listen, somebody who wants to help, and somebody who will resolve their problem given the time and the opportunity to do so. Once somebody understands that, I don't care if it's a parent-child relationship, teacher-student relationship, city situation, black, white, you know, religious thing, whatever it is, if you can take the time and explain what it is you would like to be able to do and have that person give you the courtesy of at least thinking that what you are speaking is the truth. So many issues could be resolved without violence, without escalation, without a burning down of a community to make a point. To me, I see newscasts. I don't watch the news at night because I wouldn't sleep, because I'm thinking this is so ridiculous. This is so unnecessary. This doesn't accomplish anything. Please, let's all join hands and sit down and talk with each other, not just talk to them. It's a wrong preposition. Talk with each other. And if we can talk with each other and begin to understand why certain issues are so important to people, even though they're not important to us, if they're important to them, if they give you reasons why they're important, and you can understand those reasons, you can also begin to help them to help themselves to accomplish what they want to accomplish.
John, if you're talking to somebody that's very angry and they have a different view about things than you do, what is the process that you go through emotionally in your head, physically, so that you do not respond back with anger, even though you're feeling inside of yourself an anger for the way that they view life?
Well, I know I have a reputation for being a little kooky and a little over the top, over the edge as far as my humor, as I choose to call it, that's humor with a small h. I will take the most ugly, serious situation and try desperately to develop a humorous backdrop or a humorous context within which that issue exists. And we'll try not to make fun of the individual. No. But to actually create some humor around the ludicrousness of how the situation has evolved and developed. I kind of have a theory in my counseling background is if I could find the thorn in the paw and remove that thorn, I can begin the healing process. And sometimes counselors, and I don't mean to be critical of my own profession, but sometimes counselors get so busy dealing with the effects, they forget to dig down deep and find the trigger, find the cause, find the incident, find the situation that began this whole turmoil or whatever you want to call it. And I do in my office, I did in my office what some people would say was laser counseling. I would accomplish it maybe 2 or 3 sessions, which many counselors would take months to do. I wasn't in it for money because it was a public institution, so I wasn't going to get thousands of dollars of visits. But what I was able to do is when I saw a student, I never knew if I was going to see that student a second time. So I would, the old farmer's analogy metaphor, I bring a whole wagon load of hay now for the one horse that was standing there waiting to be fed. And I would try and get as much of that hay uploaded so that horse would not only get a meal or a mouthful at that time, but would have additional food there for later. And people thought, you know, these word pictures that I would paint, and I would tell my students, I said, well, I never took any art classes, but what I attempt to do is to paint a picture for you and hang it on the wall of your mind so that if you are dealing with a certain issue, and if I can paint a picture which helps you to understand and resolve that issue, then every time you pass by that picture and you see it, you will be energized, motivated, afforded an opportunity to regain your strength to deal with that issue. And I use this a lot with people who are dealing with substance abuse or other kinds of behavioral issues. Sometimes the old scared straight kind of thing, and I can't actually publicly talk about some of the word pictures I painted for some of the guys who were substance abusers. But I've come real close to having a couple guys throw a punch at me, but afterwards they give me a hug later, weeks later, saying, you know, I really wanted to punch you out because you just were in my face about this. But thank you, thank you, thank you. I've started to go straight. I think I'm going to make it. Can I see you anytime again? I said, yes, I'll give you a pass. You can go right to the head of the line. When you get bigger, they start laughing. They say, oh, would you stop, Mr. B? not too much humor. And I'd say, God bless you for having the courage and the strength to start this journey to being sober, to being straight, and all, et cetera, et cetera. That was my greatest joy. I would drive home and say, thank you, Lord, for giving me the opportunity to possibly change somebody's life for the better. And that was more important to me, and I mean this honestly. You know, people are going to say, no. That was more important than the paycheck. Really. Because it fed my soul. It fed my soul and my heart. The rest of it was all just, thank you very much. I'll cash my paycheck. I'll pay my bills. I'll buy food. I'll take care of my family. But feeding your soul and feeding your heart, wow, how do you put a price on that?
You can.
It's priceless. And what is the value of a human life? A human life is priceless, and yet we are so tight-fisted when it comes to early intervention and prevention. So many of the issues, I mean, there's a heroin epidemic that makes that deviate a little bit here. Right now here in Ohio, and nationwide, but here in Allen County, in Ohio, the opiate and heroin epidemic is a pandemic. Just to point out how horrible it is, the CEO of the Chamber of Commerce here in Lyon said his greatest frustration, John, was 3 out of 4 potential employees who would otherwise be hired on the spot with their skill sets and life experiences can't pass the drug test. 75%. What the heck? Why are we allowing this to happen? And everybody's pointing fingers at whose job it is. No, it's everybody's job. The churches, the public, the private, the faith-based, everybody, political, regardless of party, regardless of socioeconomic, join hands and go to war with this epidemic of drugs, which is killing our kids, completely unraveling our families, and creating, well, as far as I'm concerned, this is the quiet war which is defeating the United States. We don't see any bullets and we don't hear any planes flying overhead, but what we have is we have the serpent of addiction that is strangling every person in this country, and I'm starting to lose a little bit of my articulateness because of this. My emotions on this are so, so strong. I started a group down here called HELP, which is the Heroin Epidemic Leadership Project. Just made arrangements to help get a 26 apartment unit set up for detox and for sober living. Working at the advisory committee for COVID Behavioral Services, which is a treatment, if you will. I'm still carrying forth my mental health background from Michigan, but down here, it's the group that provides services for people who are addicts and mentally ill, et cetera, on their advisory board. And it just, we have to address some of these social issues because I refer to it as it's toxifying. It is toxifying the environment in which our children and grandchildren are growing up, and it is toxifying them. And for us to sit and point fingers at whose job it is without realizing that we are one, and as one, I can do something and step forward and join hands with our neighbors, members of our faith groups and members of our social clubs, etc., and fight this epidemic, or we are lost. We are lost as a country. We are lost as a civilization. And I really get a little preachy on this, and I apologize.
No, I like that about you. I think you call it preachiness. I call it sharing your heart, how you see humanity working together, one person at a time, one little difference that you make in someone's life like you made for mine, inspired me to go on and do things because I felt so good when you passed on the compliments to me that I never had any idea that any I had inside of me. I didn't see that. So your kind words, actually I've seen your humor at work. I think that humor is a big part of it takes a strong intellect, though, to come up with something that does not offend somebody, but yet diffuses the situation.
I used to say one of my lines in the office is I'd say, my students, I said, laugh with me or laugh at me, but please laugh, because humor is the best therapy. It's free. And when you laugh, the drawbridge goes down and you allow me to enter into your minds and your hearts and souls, and I can start kind of rearranging some of your furniture for you. And you won't even know I was there until you try and find your favorite chair, and it's not there, it's been moved. But humor helps, and sometimes the ludicrousness of a situation absolutely mandates you to laugh at it, because you say, oh my golly, how can this be happening? And then you realize it's a whole series of circumstances where the wrong choices, the wrong attitudes, the wrong behaviors, the wrong everything just all came together in a confluence and created this storm or maelstrom that people find themselves in. And if you can help with the weather report and let them know that this will pass, then you can save a lot of panic attacks and anxiety attacks and other things. And I just feel very blessed. Looking back, there are many, a lot of people say, woulda, coulda, shoulda, things I'd change. You know what? There isn't very much in my life that I would change or do differently. Do better? Yeah. Do differently? Probably not. And I feel very much at peace as I approach the final roll call. I feel very much at peace that I have done the best that I could do for the right reasons, and hopefully leave a legacy for my children and grandchildren. And so far, my three sons, I will absolutely say, I am so proud of each of them following different paths, but each of them being good husbands, good fathers to their children, and good in each of the professions that they've chosen. So, that's as far as my ripple effect goes. I'll still be very happy, but hopefully it's gone a little farther. My students used to say, they'd come back later and they'd say, well, Mr. Boker, you really helped us so much. What can we do for you? And I said, well, there's one thing you could do for me. Whatever you think I did for you, go find somebody in your circle of friends, your family, your neighbors, and do for them whatever you think I did for you. That will be my legacy.
And I shall pay forward your kindness and your willingness to speak with me tonight and share this with whoever is with me. So I wish you wonderful good health. Just appreciate you taking the time to speak.
Now my new phrase, Lois, is have a blessed day, blessed week. It's amazing. When you use those words, people hear you speaking from your soul, in your heart, and not just your mouth.
Thank you very much.
You are welcome, and thank you.
On behalf of Integrity in Action, we want to thank you for listening to Integrity in Action with Lois Shulman. Join us monthly the third Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. For more information on guests, your host Lois Shulman, please visit BodyMindSpiritRadio.com and visit the Integrity in Action show page. Until next time, good night.